not using a source packet, not in our traditional way, but kind of a little bit of a different way of looking at it. And it's such a difficult topic. It takes me to a very sad and very dark place when I go to prepare. So I have a whole section. Some of you know that on Tisha B'Av I spend a lot of time talking about these types of topics. I have a whole section of bookshelves in my office that have these books. And just going back there, it's a depressing feeling. It's such a dark place to even think about and to talk about it, but we need to. So to think about the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz this past week, I mentioned over Shabbos in Lincolnwood that these people who have endured this terrible experience are becoming fewer and fewer in our community. So I'll just mention anecdotally, Nechama thinks this may be the worst haircut that I ever got, especially in the back. She thinks it's a terrible haircut. But I will tell you, it's definitely the best haircut I ever got.
It was free.
Nope. It was one of the more expensive.
It was from
I went to a barber last month. The man is 95 years old.
A survivor.
He has been a barber in Chicago, he told me, for 64 years. And he tells me that before that, he was a barber for 3 years in Auschwitz. Mm. And before that, he was a barber in Plunsk, which is the town that Ben-Gurion was from. 6,000 Jews in a small Polish town of Plunsk. And the man tells me, his name is Benny, he tells me that he still remembers, that the Rav in his town in Plunsk was a tall man, carried himself with great dignity, and he says the Poles in his community, in their town, when they would see the Rav, the Shtad Rav, walking down the street, they would tip their cap to him. He said he remembers as a child that the Ger Rebbe came to their town, and all of the Jews came to the street to walk the Ger Rebbe. He said that Polacks didn't know what was going on. It was like a parade. And he said that when he was in Auschwitz, he was the barber in his barracks, and because the capo in his barracks liked the shave that he got, he gave him an extra cup of soup. Mm-hmm. And he says it was interesting that his father had told him when he was 15 years old when he started to be a barber, he says, what are you going to be a barber for? How much do you get for a haircut? 10 cents. 10 cents for a haircut. So he told me he was a barber for 3 years in Auschwitz until he got some kind of the agency after the war sent him to Chicago, and this is where he came. What a haircut. I never asked a barber in my life for a bracha until this haircut. Mm-hmm. It was unbelievable. Man, 95 years old, still coming to work. So he says he told the Rabbonu Shalom, as long as he has a reason to come, he'll pay his rent, he's going to still keep coming. So you can't turn down a haircut like that. It was unbelievable. So to meet people like that are really our unique opportunities today, because they don't happen so often. They're harder to come by. So I wanted to reflect on this morning on three different aspects. The first one is generally on the concept of Zechira. The second one is in terms of some personalities who are related to Auschwitz specifically, not just the Shoah in general, but Auschwitz in specific. And then the third is a very, very thumbnail sketch of religious reflections. So the first, in terms of the mitzvah of Zechira, so we have a tradition that there are multiple zechiras. There are different things that we are supposed to remember. So there's a question, is it a formal mitzvah to remember these things, or is it just a good idea? Some people say in the morning, like I think my father says this, I think he says every morning the sheish zechiros, the six things at the end of the shachris and the siddur. I think my father, if I recall correctly, my father does it. So you remember Yetzias Mitzrayim, you remember Ma'an Torah, and what else do you remember?
Miriam.
You remember Miriam, and you remember Amalek.
And Shabbos,
that's right. So in the context of remembering Amalek, so it's something to think about. We are actually most accustomed to thinking about remembering Amalek because there's a specific mitzvah in the Chumash, Zachar and Lo Tishkach, which we do every year with the reading mitzvah d'oraisa, reading a parsha of Amalek. So what exactly are we remembering? Are we remembering, and this could be a whole discussion in and of itself, are we remembering the fact that there's evil in the world and that we need to eradicate it? You know, what exactly is Amalek? Remember what they did to us, who they were. So that itself is an interesting question. There was a man, he was a lawyer, but a tremendous scholar. in Torah study in Tel Aviv. His name was Abraham Korman. So I have an uncle, my father's brother, Moish. So he introduced me to this Abraham Korman many years ago. And he's a very prodigious, I think he died maybe 15 years ago, 20 years ago, a prodigious scholar. He wrote many Sfarim, like 25 Sfarim. And these very interesting ideas. So one of his ideas, he tries to trace the origins of Amalek, and he observes that Amalek didn't really have a specific place where they lived, according to the Tanakh. Because originally in Bereishis, in the time of the four kids, the five kings, they are the Sedei HaAmaleki, the field of the Amalekites. Well, is it the Amalekites' place? It sounds different then. It's the field of the Amalekites, not the Amalekites' place. And then we find them later on. Where are they? They're in the south, where the Jewish people are leaving Mitzrayim. They're in the south of Israel. What do they do? We thought they were up there in the north, and then they're in the south. So Rabbi Korman, he suggests that Amalek never actually had a specific land. He said they were parasitic nomads. He said they went from place to place, leeching off of the vulnerable populations. Later on, where do we find them? Later on, we find them somewhere else, near the Caney, with Sisera. That was yesterday's Haftorah, with the Shiras Devorah attacking Amalek. So they're all over the place. He says, you know why? Because they were just, they were plunderers. They went from place to place, taking from other people, the shorish of all Ra, of the concept of Netila. So we could discuss it from that angle. But there is an interesting discussion in some Achronim about the personification of Amalek. And that is that there may be two different aspects of Amalek, and this is something that's discussed in the Soloveitchik circles. The Torah describes yesterday that Vayavo Amalek, Vayilochim im Yisrael Berufidim. Well, why did they come? So Rashi says, Rifidim Sherafu Yedehim in HaTorah. That we were not strong in our connection to the Ribbono Shel to our Torah, and because of that spiritual lacuna, so that we were vulnerable to Amalek, which is, that's one aspect. But why Amalek? And why did they come? So, it sounds like from the Chumash that they just came because. They just came because. There's a famous medrash in the Parshas Kisetze that Amalek was like somebody who jumps into a hot bath, even though he's going to get scalded, just to cool it off. Just to kind of temper the experience for other people. So there is this kind of like capricious nature of Amalek. There was, what was the motivation? So some have suggested that there may be two aspects of Amalek, and this is something that we remember in a day and age where it's unbelievable. You would think that in the year 2014, humanity would have learned, but anti-Semitism is alive and well today as it was any other time. That there is a concept not just of biological and genealogical Amalek, which maybe we lost after Sancheiriv, maybe we don't know who they are. But there's also a conceptual, theoretical Amalek. And that would be anybody who hates Jews for no reason. They had no reason to hate us. They came to us in the desert, Vayova Amalek, out of nowhere. We're a band of slaves, just emancipated, wandering around. But they hated us. We don't even know why. There's no reason. And today, that's exactly the same thing. Now, it's even more, perhaps, Yaffa Eliach, in one of her essays, points out how part of the uniqueness of the Holocaust is in this dimension in terms of the kind of hatred that it was. Where traditionally, obviously there's been so much written about anti-Semitism, but think about it, traditionally, for most of 1700 years, anti-Semitism was religiously motivated, certainly, let's say, since the beginning of Christianity. So Christian anti-Semitism, they claim that we killed their deity, so therefore they hated us. They claim that we, you know, we crucified their God, and okay, or we rejected their truths when it comes to Islam, so we're infidels. So there was a religious reason to hate us. But by the middle of the 19th century, there was a shift. It's no longer religious anti-Semitism. It's not that people hate us because we're Jewish, or we have a Jewish religion. They hate us because of our quote-unquote race. The term anti-Semitism was coined in 1876 by Wilhelm Marr. But before the 19th century, there was an out. If somebody wanted to be spared persecution, what would they do? They would either be expelled, and they could still live. You wanted to live, so go somewhere else. Gesund to hate. It wasn't that they were going to chase you down from the far corners of the earth. They didn't want to eradicate you. They didn't want you here. We were, as it says in the beginning of Kino, Schiu Maus. They said they were gross and the devil and all
what
that.
About the Spanish Inquisition?
So they said, Gesund to hate, go somewhere else. The Spanish, they had no problem with us being Jewish. You go find somewhere else to live. You want to go live in Morocco? You want to go live in Madagascar? That's okay. Then we're going to chase us down to Madagascar. Or take the Spanish Inquisition. Or convert. From our perspective, it's not an option. But, okay. And unfortunately, in the Spanish period, many hundreds of thousands of Jews did. Whether they did sincerely or they had underground Jewish communities, whatever it is. But that you could have been spared. But when it comes to racial anti-Semitism, there is no, you could be spared. There is no outlet. It's the ultimate pursuit of destruction for no real reason except to say that our race is invalid, essentially. And that, perhaps, is the embodiment of Amalek. So when you talk about Zechiras Amalek, in the conceptual sense, that's you're looking at it straight in its most hideous and terrifying form. Hatred for no reason, with no escape. So that's the first thing that we remember. We remember that this concept of Amalek is still out there. That's Aleph. But in contrast to that, there are people who rose above the indescribable horrors in really amazing and astonishing ways. And I'll share with you just three of these individuals. And it's important to keep in mind, it's a little bit tricky sometimes because there are a lot of different stories in different places. And Rabbi Weinreb, who is, I would say, my Rebbe in Tisha B'Av in Yonim, because his Tisha B'Av program is like no other, so that's where I experienced Tisha B'Av. He once pointed out that even though we would like them to be true, he pointed out that not every Holocaust story is true. There was a particular story that I still remember distinctly from when I was in high school that stuck in my mind from Tisha B'Av, because I used to go to hear him in Shomrei Emunah in Baltimore, and Rabbi Liebtag also used to go. That was their shul. So one year, I'm preparing for Tisha B'Av, I called Rabbi Liebtag and said, do you remember this such and such story that I heard? He said, of course I remember it. And he said he knew that Rabbi Weinreb found out afterwards that the memoir that it had been taken from was actually fabricated. It had been discredited. So then I was in touch with him and with Rabbi Weiner about whether or not he even tells that story anymore because it had been discredited. So it's always more powerful when you can go back to the source of the story. So I want to introduce you to three people. Some of them you've heard of and some of them maybe you haven't. This first one is Rav Yekusiel Yehuda Halberstam, the Kloisenberger Rebbe. So some of the people in this room maybe even remember the Kloisenberger Rebbe. So the Kloisenberger Hasidim are a Hungarian group, and he spent a period of time in Auschwitz, but after that he spent much of his time in other places, in work camps and a place called the Moldorf Forest, and then a couple of other places, and Dachau for a little bit, and the Death March. And his story is just an unbelievable story, and it's a testament to something that I wouldn't even, a standard that I wouldn't hold myself to, in the sense that we are accustomed to living in the Derech HaTeva. We live in the natural world, and the Torah encourages us to live in the natural world, which is very good. And that's what we're supposed to do. But there are certain people, apparently, you see it, that they just live in a different world. They live Me'al HaTeva. And the Rebbe describes in this book that during the war, he never ate bishul akum. Bishul akum. He never ate bishul akum. Forget he never ate treif. He never ate bishul akum. It's unbelievable. For the places that he went and everything he went through. And he describes how at certain points he felt that he was mamish near death, but the Ribono Shel Olam intervened to take care of him. And that's like one model of being able to, you know, if you were to have written to Rav Oshri, who was in the Kovno ghetto, so he has the child's and chuvas to be a mamak, and he survived the war, moved to Brooklyn. So he would have told you, the psak is, the din is, you have to eat non-kosher food. It's a mitzvah. It's a chiyuv. The Rambam would say that a person who would endanger their life by not eating the non-kosher food perhaps is liable for their own life, for endangering their own life. The Rambam would say that that person is a criminal. And yet there are certain people, certain spiritual giants, who encountered this world and they were able to transcend it in such a way that it didn't compromise them at all. He even describes that for a certain period of time, he wore a sheet wrapped around his face, which for a while he was able to get away with, so he wouldn't have to shave his beard, because that was part of his tradition, that he wouldn't shave. Now, at a certain point, they wouldn't let him do that, and they gave him certain beatings where he had to. But the idea of being so connected to the Ribbono Shel Olam that you can literally transcend everything that's going on, even at a physical level, it's just mind-boggling. So I saw recently something incredible. You can go on YouTube, you can see this, Mamish, today. In September of 1945, the Supreme Allied Commander, Dwight Eisenhower, visited some DP camps. He went with a group of people, and you can see, if you Google it, there is an archivist online who posts, you can buy it, you can download, and you see a 2-minute video clip of Eisenhower arriving at this DP camp, and there are little children waving flags, and they have people, throngs of people following him, and it's September, I think it was September 17th, that's what it says on the side. And lo and behold, if you do, you go to hebcal.com where you can convert the dates, September 17th, 1945 is the 10th of Tishrei. It was Yom Kippur. Mamash Maisa Shahaya. And at the end of the 2-minute clip, you see that Eisenhower is walking into a building, and on the front of the building it says Base Tefila. And the place was called Feldafing. And that day, it was Yom Kippur. Eisenhower was visiting Feldafing, and who was essentially the spiritual master of the Jews in Feldafing? It was the Kloisenberger. And in this volume, they describe what it was like watching the interaction between the Kloisenberger Rebbe and Eisenhower, and that they both spoke. And there was a guy there, a Frum guy, who was the translator for Eisenhower on that visit. His name was Meyer Birnbaum. My grandfather, Olav Shalom, knew him. So I tracked down, there is a book, it's called Lieutenant Birnbaum. And he corroborates it in his memoirs, and he describes that he had been with Eisenhower on more than one occasion. And Eisenhower said to him that day in Feldafing, he says, "I think I remember you." And he says, "Yes, I was translating for you somewhere else," because he was a Yiddish-speaking boy who was traveling around. So they attached him to Eisenhower to translate on Yom Kippur in Feldafing. Unbelievable. So I'll share with you one Maisa from the Kloisenberger the night before. That's what he describes. So it's Kol Nidre night in Feldafing. So he looks at the people, and they have all the davening. After Kol Nidre, the Rebbe gets up to speak, and they describe how beforehand he had been very, very sick and very weak. But he got up to speak, and he took the machzor, and he opens the machzor, and he says to all the people, he starts reading through all the vidui. He says, "Ashamnu, who wrote this?" He says, "Who wrote this? This wasn't written for us." And he went through each of the videos and each of the al-chayt. Says, "Al-chayt shechatan lefanecha be-gilei arayos." He said, "Did anybody have any havamina of gilei arayos this year? Gazalno, did we steal anything?" So he says, "Yes, you know what I stole one time," the Rebbe says to the whole group. He says, "One time I stole because..." It's unbelievable. He says, "One time I stole because I came back late at night and I was so tired and exhausted, but my skin got caught in the wood, in the slats. And I tried to get out and I couldn't get it out. And when I finally yanked it out, it ripped and I was bleeding and I moaned. And when I moaned," he says, "I woke up the guy next to me and I stole from him. I stole his sleep." He says, "But otherwise, Gazalnu, Dibarnu Dofi, did anybody talk Lashon Hara? Did anybody have any time to talk about anything?" He goes through the whole thing, and he closes the machzor in front of everyone. And then he says, "But we have a different vidui to say." He says, maybe what we need to say vidui for is that we doubted you, Ribono Shel'Olam. Maybe because when we went to bed at night, we actually thought, we hoped this would be the last time we had to go to sleep. He says, that's what we have to say vidui for. And that's what we want to make up with you right now. We want to apologize for the times that we didn't hold on to you as tightly as we should have. It's mizazeah. Like, if it wouldn't be such a person to say that, you would stone such a person. You would throw them out. But that's, I think that's one literally superhuman spiritual figure who that was his life. And then he went from camp to camp as an activist, making sure they had food. And then Sukkot describes getting Dalad Minim and working with the American government to try to help them. It's just unbelievable. Unbelievable. But that was his devotion. So I mention him because he did spend a short period of time in Auschwitz before he was taken to Dachau to the Moldar Forest. That's one story. Another story is a story from Chicago, from the Weizen Rav. The Weizen Rav that probably many people in this room met. I never met him. So someone once gave me, when we moved here, someone gave me a small collection of essays that are, it's called Shar Machmadim. He has a separate set of Svarim, but this is a small kuntras called Shar Machmadim. And in it, he describes his experience in Auschwitz with... it's like, it's just incredible. So the other side, he has it in English. He has both. So he describes, he was there on Rosh Hashanah. And he describes exactly what happened, both in Hebrew and English. But one part of the story, there was a group of 1,400 boys who were held in an isolated barrack. And one of them sent word, because they had heard, that the Weizen Rav had a shofar. Remember, most of the Hungarian Jews arrived in Auschwitz way late in the war. That was the last push by the Nazis, the Germans, Yimach Shemam V'Zichram, Operation, I think it was called Erntfest or Harvestfest or something, to round up the Jews of Hungary, and they went in by the tens of thousands by day. He says there was a request from these boys in this isolated barrack who were going to go to the left that he should come and blow the shofar for them. So his son, Zalman Leib, told him, he says, you can't go. He begged him not to go, because if he gets caught over there, that'll be the end. And it's the mitzvah of shofar. He says, these boys, they've heard the mitzvah of shofar before. It's pikuach nefesh, you can't go. So he writes, he was a big Talmud Chacham, he says, I admit that my decision did not go according to the halacha. I knew full well that endangering one's life for the sake of blowing the shofar is forbidden, but my decision was at that moment was based solely on the fact that my life had little value at that time in Auschwitz anyway, because who knows what was going to happen. So he describes that he went to blow the shofar, he snuck into this barrack, and the stipulation was that his son, Zalman Leib, would stand outside and keep an eye. If anybody was coming, he would have to run. So he gets to the barracks and he describes, he says, not a writer or a poet in the entire world can portray my feelings as I entered the sealed barracks. And then what did the boys say to him? They said, we need you to give a drasha. He says, say something to us. He says, they wouldn't let me continue. I finally relented. I spoke words of drush, focusing on the words, bakes aliyom kagenu. And then he said that he spoke to him about different aspects of Shema Yisrael. And finally, he says, I tell you this story so the future generations will know the great Mesiras Nefesh and the holy words that I heard from these young boys. He says that one of the kids yelled out, he says, the Rebbe has strengthened us by telling us that even when a sharp sword is upon our throats, we should not despair. But I say to you, we should hope for the best. We have to prepare for the worst, so we should say Shema Yisrael. So they all said Shema Yisrael, and the Rebbe blew the shofar for them. They had not had any food or drink for 24 hours because they had been locked up. Even though it was forbidden for them to fast, they had no choice, obviously. And he says, he had to run out, essentially, after he blew the shofar to get back to his barracks. But just, this is not above my, so this happened, b'didei ha'avodah. And finally, one more story, just a connection to Auschwitz, and that was that in this volume, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, Shalita, the former chief rabbi of Israel, so this is the original version, the Hebrew version of his autobiography, which is now published in English, so the general public can read it, and it's really an amazing story. But he describes there an unbelievable story also of amazing emunah. His father, he comes from a generations of, I forget, 20 generations or 40 generations of Rabbanim. So his father, Rav Moshe Chaim Lau, was the Rav in Piotrków, which is the town, the Polish town where he was from. Piotrków happens to be a famous Polish town, for the reason that they had a printing press there that was widely used. So many Sfarim that were published before the war happened to have been published in Piotrków. I don't know why that was. It was just kind of a thing. But before he was the Rav in Piotrków, he was a Rav in a Czech community. I forget the name of it. I'll see. I'll tell you. I forget the name of the place. I don't have it in front of me. So it turns out that where is it? Can't find it right now. Oh, wait. No, I don't see it now. It turns out that his father had left this previous Rabbanus position, but was taken and then went to Piotrków, and then when his train arrived, it was in Treblinka, that his train arrived with the Jews of Piotrków, who was arriving at the same time? The Jews of the previous community who had not hired a rabbi in the interim. And so Rav Yisrael Meir Lau describes how he heard from two different eyewitnesses that when the Jews got together, it was the Jews of this previous community in Czechoslovakia and the Jews of his current Kehila, and he led all of them together to say Ani Mamin and Shema Yisrael when they went to their death in Treblinka. And why do I bring this today when we talk about Auschwitz? Because Rav Lau has become a symbol of someone who went back. Many photographs of him in Auschwitz. I think they have one in here. Let's see if I can find it. He was the youngest person who was liberated from Buchenwald. Okay, this is Buchenwald. I think there was a picture. I saw a picture. I don't know if I saw it in this book, of when he went back years later to commemorate the liberation of Auschwitz many, many years later. And he, I would say, is one of the great spokespeople and representatives of our community when it comes to this. But the idea that there was so much emunah is really, at least to me, it's just, it leaves you without words, just the spiritual heroism. So these are three individuals, two of whom are not living, but one of whom is living. So these are three different books. If you're interested in this topic, you can read more about them. They have some connection to Auschwitz in some way, that they were there or they represent, connect to it. But I wanted to do now is move to the third idea, and that is talk about religious responses to the Holocaust. Now, there's been a ton of research into different aspects and religious responses of the Holocaust, and we could have a long, long discussion about it with sources. Rabbi Eitan Ehrenfeld spent a lot of time and collected last year in the Kollel, 2 years ago, I forget which one. We had a lot of discussions with Mark Kummels, so I'm indebted to him for Xeroxing some of the articles that I used. So I would say we can break it down into five different ways of looking at the Holocaust. And this is something, I don't, obviously, this is not for eighth graders, but in a truncated, small version. This is something that I would share and have shared many times with students in Hillel Torah and Ari Crown when talking with them about the Holocaust. It's a very difficult talk about the Ribono Shalom, God, and the Holocaust, but having the kids understand that it's okay to ask the question, how does a thinking, observant person deal with the Holocaust, that the question is okay to ask, and the fact that there are more than one approaches to it is also very important for the kids to understand. And I think it's important for us in general in Yiddishkeit to know that it's not one way or the highway. There are different approaches. You might disagree with some of them. Some of them we might think are dead wrong, but we should just know that there are different approaches. So this first approach, which I still remember was so interesting, when I asked in a group of students if this approach resonated with any of them, one of them said it did. Now, even though I personally find it very, I would say, almost untenable. But the first approach is what we could call the Schar V'Onesh approach. So we say in Musaf Davening, Umepnei Chata'enu Golino Me'artzenu. So obviously there must have been some Avera, some sin that we did. So we'll call this Schar V'Onesh. That precipitated the punishment that was meted out to the Jewish people in the Holocaust. Now this is championed on one side by Rav Yoel Teitelbaum of Satmar, well known, who said that essentially the Holocaust was the result of the Zionist movement. That's one side. But I saw Rabbi Lam, should live and be well, Dr. Lam, and Rabbi Sachs both quote an Israeli scholar who I didn't look up. I think in the 50s, his name was Hartom. I never heard of him outside of this, who wrote a whole essay with the arguing the exact opposite, that the Holocaust was essentially an onish for not taking up the opportunity. So this is one approach, Schar V'Onesh, and if that works for you, gesund to hate, because there's definitely, that is an important aspect of Jewish approaches to life. The Rambam says in Hilchos Tainis that if bad things happen to you and you say, oh, it's just a mikra ba'alma, it's just a it's a happenstance. The Rambam uses an interesting word. He says it's achzorius.
Those who argue Schar V'Onesh, are they talking about on a collective level, or are they talking about for each individual who got killed?
So it's hard to know what that means. You know, there are one, and again, this, like I said in the beginning, this is hard to understand what it means when you talk about 1.5 million children. What does that even mean? Mm-hmm. What does that mean? So, it's an unanswered question.
But it's also very interesting the
story of the Harugei Malchus. Yeah, so we'll come back to how far back you can go in a minute.
Yeah.
Well,
it's very interesting that Rabbi Teitelman claims Schar V'Onesh, but he's the one who got out of the Holocaust.
So that's a point that Dr. Lamb makes, which is the Gemara has a
with a lot of money and a lot.
That's not true. That's not true. I could tell you, my grandmother, she lived me well. My grandmother came from a special family. Their name is Fink. They lived in Scranton. Before that, they were in Taylor. And so my great grandfather had a general store, and they had cows. And my grandmother used to bring milk to Williamsburg to the Rebbe's, because there was like Chol V'Yisrael milk that they could get from our family in Scranton. So it happens to be that the Kapishnitzer Rebbe was the Shadchan for my grandmother, because she used to bring milk to Williamsburg and Borough Park. And my grandfather, Olav Shalom, his father was a Rav. So the Kapishnitzer said, oh, I have a friend who has a son, and you know, this fine family from Scranton, they send milk, so it's a good shidduch. So my grandmother once told me that she went once in, I think it was the late 40s, to bring milk by train from Scranton to the city. She went once to the Satmar, and she said that there was a woman there who was on her hands and knees cleaning the floor, and she walked past her, and then she realized later it was the Rebbetzin, that they were so poor they couldn't hire a cleaning lady.
I'm sorry, I didn't phrase it right. They had money paid off.
Let's clarify it. They had no money.
No, I didn't say they had money.
They had no money. That's
somebody
not the issue.
Somebody got them out. That's the only thing.
There are many people who had the opportunity to get out. There are many people who got out. There's a different way of saying it.
But they kept telling their own Hasidim, don't leave.
We could discuss that particular Nakuda, even though I happen not to agree with the Satmar on this point. That's a separate discussion, a complex discussion. But Dr. Lamb's point is, you know what we say in Musaf? We say, Mipnecha ta'enu galinu me'artzenu. We did these averos, so we're going to get punished. He says it's very fine to say. It doesn't say mipnei chatoe hem. Somebody else. Who are you to make a cheshbon on somebody else's averos? And who are you to pretend to think that you know the calculus, the Ribbono Shel Olam, is, so to speak, the accountant of the Ribbono Shel Olam? So this is a very, very, I would say, very problematic approach to the Holocaust, especially because perhaps one could say that the nature of the Holocaust is even some which may enter into a new calculus in terms of the scope of which had not been seen in previous generations, maybe during the Korban Beis HaMikdash, or maybe even before. So that's one approach. Another approach comes back to the Chazon Ish. I saw from the Chazon Ish, but it comes to this book, which I will share with you. So I love this exercise. What is this? Anybody guess what this is? Anybody know?
A hand?
Could be a hand.
Crown.
Yeah, it's the head, it's the crown of a rooster. So this is great with students of all ages. So it's a rooster, right? But actually, it's not. It's really a rooster. But really, what you're looking at is the picture of children. And then you go through the whole book. It's called Zoom. It's written by a guy by the name of Istvan Banyai. And I bought it for exactly this purpose, because the Chazon Ish explains, and as you keep going through the book, you start to realize, he says, we're way too close to the event to even think about interpreting it. Because what happens is, as you go farther and farther back, you thought you were looking at the crown of a rooster, but you're really not. You're really looking at a child playing on a table, but really you're not. You're looking at a magazine, but that's not really what you're looking at. You're really looking at somebody in a chair who's actually going to be in a postcard, and you keep going v'chein hala, until all the way at the end, that's what you're looking at.
It's never what it seems like.
It's the world. And the point of this book, it's called Zoom, is you keep zooming back and back and back, and what looked like, if you ask me what this is and what this book is about, what's it a picture of? Well, I thought it was the picture of the crown of a rooster, but it's not. It's really the picture of a stamp on an envelope of a... So this is the Chazon Ish's perspective, and we'll call it Zoom. That you can't have a reaction because it's too close. A third perspective is offered and articulated by Rabbi Lamb, Dr. Lamb, Shalom be well, as well as Rabbi Sachs in slightly different ways. They first begin by, Rabbi Lamb does it with the stridency, taking on the perspective of the Schar Va'onesh, and Rabbi Sachs does it with a little more, just kind of says it's there. He's not going to make too many comments. But they both come up with the next idea, which is called, we refer to it as Hester Panim. Who ran the death camps? Did the Ribbono Shel Olam run the death camps? So on one level, there's Hashgacha Pratis. Hashgacha Pratis means that the Ribbono Shel Olam runs everything. But there's another idea, and this is what Dr. Lamb and Rabbi Sachs both developed. There's a concept that you can begin to think about called Hester Panim. What is Hester Panim? It quotes the Rambam, the Mor Nevuchim, that if we don't merit the Hashgacha of the Ribbono Shel Olam, is going to leave us to just the winds of the world. And then it's really fate that will determine what's going to happen to us, and we then really are subject to the mikre. Like it says, "Atem halachtem imi bekeri, afani elechem achem bekeri." You treat me like it's by chance, I treat you like by chance. Now, obviously there has to be a precipitant of Hester Panim. What was that? So that may have been the Churban Beis HaMikdash. Meaning, Dr. Lamb points out, it could be that the beginning of the Holocaust was with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And once we're in a period of Golus and Hester Panim, so he talks about actually four different strata. You talk about a Nisias Panim, when Rabbi Shalom lifts up his face to us, and then there's absolute Hester Panim, when he totally turns away to us from us, and there's complete death, and then there's stages in between. And maybe what happened is that through the course of this extremely long and protracted Golus, we're growing through different aspects, different periods of Hester Panim, where the result of Hester Panim could be that when human beings are left to their own devices, so there could be a terrible destruction. I read this past week in the Wall Street Journal, there was in a book review that described that in the last, I forget how many years, 100 years, 150 years, they said there have been 100 million people who were killed because of genocide. which they said was much more than the number of people who have died because of traditional warfare. 100 million people killed in genocide. So that's going to include Rwanda and Serbia. But you see, lo aleinu, what human beings are capable of, the level of depravity. So that may be the next question, that when you leave the Jewish people to just the fate of what human beings decide. So it wasn't the Tutsis and the Hutus, it was the Germans and the Jews. And it's not that the Baruch Shem couldn't become involved. He could. And it's not that there isn't Hashgacha Pratis. There is Hashgacha Pratis. But when you step away from the Hashgacha Pratis because of Hester Panim, then, you know, anything could happen. So that's another approach that comes.
So what comes first? Does God turn his head away, or do we step away first?
No, we step away first. But what's the way that it's interesting is not that it's a tit for tat, okay, we did this Avera, he did that. It's that because we did Averas 2,000 years ago that caused the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, like the Medrash describes, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, stepped away from the world. He says, I can't be here with you like this. So the consequence, the natural consequence of him stepping away is that there is this vacuum that's created. Now, obviously, you know, you can't say, and this is one of the things that Dr. Lamb tries to struggle with, and Rabbi Sachs also, like, okay, so then everything is left to chance. Well, you know, what about all the many miracles that happen? So there's kind of this murky relationship between Hester Panim and then Hashgacha Pratis and the Yad Hashem. You know, we know the Six-Day War was the Yad Hashem.
Plus, it seems like the Hester Panim was focused in one geographic
right.
area.
So,
where all your, you know,
so the answer to that will be that when there's general Hester Panim, so people have the human beings control, and it happens to be that it was the Germans who decided to annihilate the Jews. A few centuries earlier, the Hester Panim was manifest in, you know, Almohads in the 13th century.
It would seem, arguably, that Hester Panim is occurring now, and it's happening globally.
100%.
I mean, there's definitely... It's not fatalistic, but...
Without a Beis HaMikdash, you are in the category of Hester Panim. So the question becomes, to what degree is that? Is it absolute? He talks about low-level Hester Panim. Okay, we have just a couple minutes for the last two perspectives. And each of these, we could spend, you know, Rabbi Lamb's article is long. It's like 25 pages. And he discusses different nuances. And Rabbi Sachs also brings the question that Rabbi Lamb does in terms of trying to figure out what is meaning fit in here? What does that have to do with it? Meaning, so do you say, well, it was just by chance, so then have you robbed all of the Kedoshim of the meaning of their lives and the meaning of their martyrdom? Well, if you say, okay, well, we're going to find meaning, it, so do you diminish it by saying, the meaning, what is this? So you kind of, it is left with an unanswered calculus. Rav Amital, so he was in a labor camp in a Hungarian area, Romanian, I think, during the war, and then he came to Israel. He founded with Rav Lichtenstein, they founded Yeshivat Har Etzion. So he was asked by a newspaper toward the end of his life, and he spoke about the Shoah in different sichot. They were put on, you can get them on VBM in English, they were translated. So he recently, the last couple of years, he was interviewed by an Israeli secular magazine called Eretz Acheret, and he said, and the title of the article is Omeid Bifnei Kir. I stand before a wall. I asked him, how do you daven for Yom Noraim? He says, I'll tell you. He says, I have questions and I have no answers. He says, all the answers that I've heard, they're ridiculous. They're absolutely nothing. They're hevel, sheker v'chazav. I was there. It's nothing. He says, I have a relationship with the Rabbonu Shel Olam and I have questions. And he apparently repeated this many times. I saw it in two different places. He came across a certain well-known poet, a secular poet after the war. He says, well, which one of us is better off? You don't believe in God, you believe in man. So show me, what is your faith in man after what just happened? He says, I believe in God. I never understood God in the first place. God is beyond comprehension. So I had questions before, I have questions now. Which one of us is worse off? Which one of us is better off? So the idea that it's okay to live without questions, live without answers, is a basic principle of Yadus, lo machshavosai machshavosichem, which in this context could be understood as, we can't always fathom what the Rabbonu Shel Olam expects us to do, and what he's trying to do, and what's happening in the world. That's part of being human and finite, as opposed to Ribbono Shel Olam, which is Kol Yochel. And we know that Ribbono Shel Olam is a meitiv. He wants to do for our best. And what it means, I have no idea. And we can't understand it in this world. In the Olam HaEmes, somehow, it'll have to make sense. But in this world, ani omed b'fnekir. Rabbi tells us, I just stand in front of a wall. And that's also a response. And then the last response that we could talk about is Rav Soloveitchik's, Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik's response in Kol Dodi Dofeik. So the second half of Kol Dodi Dofeik is more well known because it deals with the state of Israel, but the first half is the Rav Soloveitchik's theological response to the Holocaust. And essentially what he says is a critical yesod that relates to a suffering bechlal. You know, there's a whole volume published by Torah Sarav called Out of the Whirlwind on Rav Soloveitchik's analysis and lectures on suffering. Apparently he was very thoughtful about many things, including suffering. I try not to spend too much time thinking about suffering, but apparently Rav Soloveitchik is very existential and other things like all those fancy words, so you got to get into suffering if you're into that kind of thing. Not my cup of tea so much. But okay, I never read Out of the Whirlwind. But this is, it's very important for people. Lo Aleinu, I remember having some discussions with one of the members of our community who is now in the Olam HaEmes, who went through this exact transformation. I heard it from Dr. Pelkovitz from a psychological point of view. So Rav Soloveitchik writes, he says, if you're going to try to find the answer to the question why the Holocaust happened, he says, you will always come up empty. Because the Ribbono Shel Olam didn't tell us, and he won't tell us why. The question of why is unknowable in this world. And if a person only pursues the question of why, they could potentially spiral downward into the abyss of despair because they're going to come up empty-handed if they're asking the question of why. What the halacha demands of us and it calls us to is not the question why, it's the question of what. What am I supposed to do with this situation? That is essentially, on one foot, an oversimplification of what Rav Soloveitchik describes, but Dr. Pelkovitz spoke about it many times in the context of people who, lo aleinu, went through challenges. And I remember sitting with this member of our community, and the first time when he was talking to me about this nebuch, this terrible thing that happened to him, and lo aleinu, we should never go through nisyonos, but he told me, I remember him talking about, you know, he wondered why did the Ribbono Shel Olam do this to him and why this happened to him. And then after a while, he started asking different questions. Okay, so, you know, what am I going to do with this now? What can he do in response to this? He says, maybe I should go and talk to people about such and such. Maybe I need to take on this project. And lo aleinu, he didn't make it. But the idea that Dr. Pelkovitz has talked about so many times, and many people in this room have experience with this, with challenges in their own lives. Baruch Hashem, I've only had so many brachas, so like I can't even relate to some of the challenges that people have. But Dr. Pelkovitz talks about, when he talks about dealing with trauma, that's his expertise, is, you know, dealing with people who have undergone traumatic experiences, whether it's plane crashes or terror victims or the tsunami or 9/11. He's dealt with all these things. So one of the things he talks about a lot is about what he talks about going from passive to active. You know, creating something, responding with being active as opposed to being passive and wondering why is this happening to me? How to make something out of a difficult situation. He talks about it from a psychological perspective in terms of bereavement, of people dealing with avelos and so many different aspects. But that's what Rav Soloveitchik says is his response to the Shoah. Because he says, to ask the question why, so I'm never going to get a good answer. Ribbono Shel Olam, I'm not a Navi. Ribbono Shel Olam is not going to tell us that we don't have Naviim. So the more important question, he says, is to ask the question what. It doesn't mean you can't ask why. Many people have asked why. This comes back to, and I didn't even mention the term, because we're focusing on specifically the Shoah, and I saw recently there's something called Shoahology. That's the whole realm of study of this question. Not just what they call theodicy, which is defending God. We don't necessarily believe in theodicy, by the way. I think Rabbi Blech makes this comment. We don't believe in theodicy. We don't need to defend God. You know, the Ribbono Shel Olam is Kol Yochol. He doesn't need us to defend him. That's the word theodicy means defense of God. But this is part of a bigger question called Tzadik V'Ra'lo. Tzadik V'Ra'lo. So Chazal have, I'm not even focusing on Tzadik V'Ra'lo because that could be like a whole series on general principles in Tzadik V'Ra'lo, and some of these emanate from those questions. There's other aspects of Yisurin Shel'ava, all different kinds of things. I'm focusing specifically on what has been said in the last several decades about the Shoah. But Rav Soloveitchik's point, which relates to all suffering bechlal and all challenges, is how to be able to move from the question of why, which is a fair question, it's a valid question, and it spurs us to think about Tzadik V'Ra'lo and the different approaches in Chazal, but ultimately says it becomes much more rewarding if you focus on the question of what. So here we are 70 years later after the opening of the gates of Auschwitz, and that question still needs to be asked. Because that question will never go away. That comes back to what we started with. The Zachor, the mitzvah of Zachor, is what's going to propel us to continue to ask the question, so what are we supposed to do? Whether we are the children of survivors, the grandchildren of survivors, just any Jewish person who has knowledge, and the more we have Zechira, the more we have that memory come alive. So what does it demand of us? What does it demand of us today? What's going to demand of future generations? The fact that we remember the Holocaust, the question why, it's a question that's on the table. But more importantly, perhaps, Rav Soloveitchik says, is the question of what. What does it mean for us, and how do we respond? So these are some thoughts that come to mind as we reflect on this time. Rav Shalom should spare everyone particularly, but all of us, bechlal, from any tzaras, and this should be the beginning of the Geula Shleima v'meher of Yameinu. Yes.
Earlier you spoke about the Olsenberger Rebbe.
Yes.